Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival. The 29th annual festival takes place this year from July 1st through 4th and includes performers like the Tedeschi Truck Band, Jimmy Vaughn and the Tilt-A-Whirl Band, Samantha Fish, and many, many more. Festival passes are on sale at early bird prices until May 31st. More information about the festival performers, the options for passes, and other information can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the One Love World Music Party Cruise, Friday, May 27th on the Portland Spirit. Boarding takes place at 10:30 p.m. The One Love World Music Party Cruise features Portland reggae band Roots Revolution and DJ Solo Afrikaan and Della playing a mix of reggae, salsa, highlife, afrobeat, dancehall, R&B, hip-hop, reggaeton, funk, and more. This is a 21 and over event. Again, that's the One Love World Music Party Cruise, Friday, May 27th on the Portland Spirit. Boarding takes place at 10:30 p.m. on the west side of the Willamette River by the Salmon Street Fountain. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Billy Bragg, Do You Want a Revolution? This is KBOO Community Radio, Radio Revolution, here in Portland, Oregon, going out to Portland, Southwest Washington, the Willamette Valley, the Columbia River Gorge, and wherever else our electronic signal reaches in the world. My name is Paul Rowland, and I'll be with you for the next hour. Yes, we did hope to have Ralph Nader. He was scheduled to be on this program this morning, but I got an email at 6:40 this morning saying that he is just swamped. He's organizing this major conference happening next week called Breaking Through Power with all kinds of interesting people involved at Constitution Hall in D.C. 3 days next week, and I guess he's just swamped with that. So they had to back out. But we do have a substitute. Sam Husseini with the Institute for Public Accuracy will be with us in a few minutes. First, as always, I have a few announcements to make. Yesterday, I saw an amazing film called How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, directed by Josh Fox, who previously directed Gasland 1 and 2. I don't often do this, but this is a must-see movie. I was really amazed, touched, overwhelmed, enthused, incited. It really has to be seen. So it's playing two more nights at Cinema 21, and a pretty full crowd, but there are still some empty seats, so I'm sure you'll be able to get one. Cinema 21 up on Northwest 21st, 616 Northwest 21st, and tonight there will be a screening and question and answer with both Josh Fox and Tim DeChristopher. And followed by a special musical performance from Fox on banjo and Gabriel Myers, his musical accompanist at the McMinimum's Blue Moo Tavern afterwards. And the question and answer goes, they let it go for a good long time, and they really let people talk, which is kind of unusual for these events. So that's nice. Also, Let Go and Love workshop with Tim DeChristopher at 10 a.m. on Thursday at the First Unitarian Church downtown, 1211 Southwest Main. And then Thursday evening, there's another added screening of this brand new movie, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival earlier. It's going to be at the Kalama VW Hall, 2282 North First Avenue in Kalama, Washington. It's at 6 o'clock on Thursday. So those are a few things happening. We'll talk more at the very end of the program with Josh Fox himself, and he'll be on tomorrow. Joanne Hardesty is going to be off tomorrow, and I stepped in at the last minute to take her place, and I'm going to have the full hour with Josh Fox tomorrow, along with Jasmine from the Columbia Riverkeeper talking about the coal terminal in Longview, and hopefully someone calling in from out there. So that's tomorrow. And coming up after this program, at 9 o'clock, a special edition, live edition of Political Perspectives with Joanne Hardesty herself, talking about the call-in show on the local elections. One last event, this Sunday, May 22nd, 3:45 to 5:45 p.m., protest the 2016 AIPAC Oregon Community Event at the Middleman Jewish Community Center, 66651 Southwest Capitol Highway. Please, there is an announcement I'm reading. Please join us in protesting the annual Oregon AIPAC event. We will start gathering in front of the venue, the Middleman Jewish Community Center, starting around 3:45. See if you can spot your favorite politician. Count the luxury vehicles. Feel the hypocrisy in the air. Seriously, we are urging politicians not to attend this event as fellow Oregonians who support peace, justice, and human rights. Their participation is taken as support for AIPAC, an extremely conservative political action group with an agenda that is not aligned with our community's values of equality, justice, human rights, and dignity for all people. So that is, and there's a whole list. I'm sure there's a Facebook event for this. You can look it up. Protest 2016 AIPAC Oregon Community Event. This Sunday, May 22nd, 3:45 to 5:45 p.m., Middleman Jewish Community Center, 6651 Southwest Capitol Highway. With all that, let's go to our guest, Sam Husseini. Good morning, Sam.
Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. And you are, those of us in the talk show business know oh so well, with the Institute for Public Accuracy, and you help provide a lot of guests for us, like, for example, Ralph Nader, who was supposed to be on this morning. And I called you looking for a substitute guest, and you agreed to be on yourself because, actually, you've been talking about the subjects that I was going to talk about with Ralph, and you have actually been somewhat critical of Ralph Nader himself. So you a more perfect person to be on, I can't even imagine.
Thank you.
And you're also the founder of VotePact.org, which encourages disenchanted Democrats and disenchanted Republicans to pair up and each vote for the candidates they genuinely want. And your most recent piece is After Sanders, A Path to Electoral Revolution. So you know that Sanders did win the Oregon primary here yesterday.
I actually, when we had our primary here in Maryland, I'm with IPA, and I'm going to talk, personally about my own voting record. IPA is not a, partisan institution, but just, I've been a registered Green for, I guess, over two decades now, and I actually changed my registration to Democrat to vote for Sanders in the Democratic primary that happened about a month ago.
So did I here in Oregon, for full disclosure.
There you go. I will be changing it back or to something else. I think that there's been a critical mistake made by Nader and by Sanders and a lot of other people who I identify with in many ways in terms of how they approach electoral politics. And has, I've actually been working on a piece on Nader with the, in this regard. My idea with Vote Pact is that the two-party system basically has people trapped because it's held together by fear and hatred. So there's the perpetual, you got to vote for the lesser evil. And that's never been seriously rebutted, not by Nader and his several runs to the White, of the White House, not by Sanders, not by Jill Stein, who's running in the Green Party this year, not by Gary Johnson, who's running in the Libertarian Party this year. The rhetoric is always, well, you know, from Nader, the two parties are both spoiled, and you can't spoil a rotten system. Yeah, that doesn't get you very far. And the effect of this, the real tragedy of it, is that you end up with a lot of people who agree with Ralph Nader or with Jill Stein or whoever, end up turning their guns against them because they are perceived as spoilers. That is, that if they get any appreciable amount of support, that they will end up throwing the election to the Republican, whether it was George Bush in 2000 or Donald Trump this year. And what I'm saying with Vote Pact is that one way out of this requires some soul searching and some work, but it is possible for, say, a Sanders supporter who's, you know, maybe just voted where you are in Oregon, but because the democratic process, so-called democratic process in the Democratic Party, is rigged in many ways, and you know, it's going to be, I think, very difficult. I think even Sanders acknowledges this, for him to end up with the Democratic Party nomination. What do you do in the November election? What I'm saying is that you find a disenchanted Republican, and you both team up and vote for the third parties of your choice. That way you're taking votes in pairs from the Democrat and Republican. Now, some people might just want to vote for a third party straight. Perhaps they've come to the conclusion that Trump and Clinton, for different reasons, are both equally noxious, and they don't, you know, they don't have a lesser evil. Then they're free. They can vote for, you know, whoever they want, green, socialist, peace and freedom, you know, whatever party they want to, assuming that they want to engage in electoral politics.
Hey, can I just interrupt you right there and,
sure.
And let's pick up that thread again in a few minutes?
Sure.
First, let me just give out our phone number. People are encouraged and welcome to contribute to this conversation, to join us at 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. The lines are open. You know, I just want to, you said Trump and Clinton, and, you know, this article you wrote was after Sanders, A Path to Electoral Revolution. But let's back up a little bit, you know, because there's, you know, Sanders just won here, you know, maybe, you know, it seems like a lot of people, I think the major media outlets wrote Sanders off months and months ago. You know, listening to NPR, they, you know, he's way before Clinton had, quote, locked up the Democratic nomination, were already basically touting her as the winner in subtle and not so subtle ways.
Absolutely.
Ditto with CNN, MSNBC, et cetera, et cetera, which is very discouraging in and of itself. But predictable. But many other people are doing the same thing in a variety of ways. And I'm not, you know, accusing you of that. But let's just back up and let's just say that Sanders, you know, is trying to force what, you know, people thought Trump was going to do before he actually did lock up the nomination, that he was, you know, trying to force an open convention and a crisis in the Republican, well, to force a crisis so that he would become the nominee. And maybe, you know, Sanders seems to be possibly heading that in that direction. And, you know, let's not write Sanders off just yet. Let's talk about what's going on within the Democratic Party itself as we developed this other critique that we're going to get back to. So, you know, what do you have to say about that? You know, maybe Sanders hasn't yet lost the nomination. Maybe we should still be putting, you know, or I should say we. I'm sorry, I can't. That's not what I mean. I said people who support Sanders maybe should be still putting energy into that campaign.
If they determine that that's a useful thing to do, then they should. I think that the tragedy of the Sanders campaign was not having a greater effort last year and early this year. You know, I think that a lot of progressive media spent a lot of time not getting out critical information of the Clinton record, Hillary Clinton's record on war, on corporate policies, and so on and so forth. I'll be frank with you. It's good to have a frank discussion. I've been quite dismayed, frankly, by Democracy Now's coverage at times, especially months ago when I think it would have had a bigger effect in terms of getting out there critical information on Hillary Clinton, the way that they are now, for example, on Trump. You know, a lot of quote-unquote progressive media is now relentlessly pointing out Trump's faults. You didn't see that pattern on a lot of that same media months ago regarding Hillary Clinton's, I'll say, crimes. I mean, you know, she obliterated Libya. She voted for the Iraq War, never really gave an accounting for that vote because there's no accounting that doesn't indict her pretty heavily. You know, there's a whole litany of policies that can and should be brought to bear in terms of her record on a wide variety of subjects. But you know, if you called me yesterday, I probably wouldn't have wanted to be on your show before the primary that you folks just had. I'm on your show now because you had your primary, and you know, if there are people who are still finding productive ways to try to advance what I hope that Sanders is doing, which is, you know, meaningfully pushing the Democratic Party to be less of a corporate and less of a militaristic party, then that's great. But you have had your primary, and some people might want to think about what they want to do down the road. I think it's important to, you know, just like I wish that some people had planned last year for the Sanders campaign more thoroughly, that might have helped them then. I think now it might be a good time to at least begin thinking about the eventuality, which, again, you know, Sanders himself is acknowledging that he may not win the nomination, because the grim likelihood is that he is going to endorse Clinton. You know, from my ideal point of view, what you could have in a, you know, in a reasonable electoral system is, you know, a genuine populist run, similar to the one that Sanders has run, although I think he could certainly be stronger on foreign policy, in the Democratic Party and one in the Republican Party, because I don't regard Trump as a serious populist. I think he just co-opted populist language for his own self-interest. And then for those two movements to merge in the general election. That's not going to happen this year because Trump has co-opted all of the populist rhetoric. But there are, you know, there are right-wing libertarians or people who are described as right-wing libertarians who might vote for the Libertarian Party, who might have in the past with great enthusiasm supported Ron Paul, and with less enthusiasm over the last year probably supported Rand Paul. You know, there are a whole cluster of issues in terms of war, in terms of corporate policies. I mean, both Clinton and Trump are members of or emissaries of the billionaire class, and you know, people, I think, need to, if they're going to engage in electoral politics, need to spend a little time, bit of time, thinking about A, how to deal with the Trump phenomena, and undermine his candidacy, and B, undermine the corporatization of the Democratic Party. That's where I'm coming at from this.
Okay, and you have this phrase, the radical center, that I'd like to get into a little bit. But we have a first caller here. Jim is on the line. Go ahead, you're on the air, Jim.
There, Jim.
Hello. I guess having some technical difficulties in the air room here, but once we get that straightened out, we encourage both Jim and whoever else wants to call in at 503-231-8187 to join us.
Thoroughly documented.
Oh, here, Jim, you're on the air. We didn't hear what you said before, so you better start again. Hello? Liam, what's going on? I guess we lost Jim. Okay, so I encourage Jim to call back and other people to call back once we get whatever is going on straightened out at 503-231-8187. So yeah, so you're critical of Nader, and in something you sent me, I guess you had also had a conversation with him, and you know he wrote that book. What was it called? The left-right book?
Unstoppable.
Unstoppable, right.
The left-right alliance against the corporate state.
Right. And you, I'm not sure when this discussion was from that you sent me the transcript of, but you criticized him directly for not taking that approach, that supposedly unstoppable left-right approach in his five previous presidential runs.
Right. You know, he ran for president multiple times, and each time he basically positioned himself to the left of the Democratic candidate, and he never put forward a meaningful strategy for winning. He, when questioned, would talk about how third-party runs helped pave the way for good policies in the past, how socialist candidates, you know, in the 40s and 30s, you know, talked about Social Security, and eventually the Democrats did it, and so on. He never articulated how he could actually win. And in that sense, I don't think that Nader ever actually ran for president. He merely used a presidential campaign to talk about various good issues that I happen to agree with. And this was the cause of tremendous frustration on my part and other people who had advised him to sort of find a way to run on a left-right manner, because then you are siphoning off votes from the two major parties and giving people a way to break out. There are millions of husbands and wives in the United States. One votes for the Democrat, one votes for the Republican. They cancel out each other. Or actually, there are probably millions more who don't go to the polls because they know they will cancel out each other. So they don't go. I'm saying that you run a campaign that appeals to both disenchanted Democrats and disenchanted Republicans, and therefore you clean up all those votes. This would imply a campaign where you get your endorsements in pairs, a local union leader and a local businessman, saying the corporate parties have destroyed my local business, have obliterated my labor standards, and we're going to break free together. You find your political mirror image, somebody who you might disagree with in a lot of ways, but you end up getting your political freedom as a result of that dialogue. So that's the idea, and his campaign was good to do it. I mean, he actually was getting some significant Republican support. He, by his own estimate, when people would call him a spoiler, he would note that in New Hampshire, the first, that he was getting, you know, like 30% of his support was Republican. But he never built on that. He never attempted to build on that. He positioned himself to run run to the left, although I don't think that he's authentically totally a leftist. But he just used that as a way to push Gore to adopt some more lefty rhetoric, which he did do at the Democratic convention in 2000. Al Gore did that, and you know, Nader, who was pushing double figures, he was like up to 8% or something in the polls, which are themselves skewed against third, you know, against independent runs. But he was getting 8% in the polls, and then after the Democratic convention, which Al Gore in 2000 branded himself a populist, similar to how we see Hillary Clinton now branding herself a progressive, and then Nader's numbers dropped, and he ended up getting whatever it was, 2% of the vote, and many people charge him, I think somewhat unfairly, with having swung the vote in Florida so that we ended up with George Bush in the White House with the Supreme Court rigging that election.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that, and, you know, Al Gore's seeming lack of fortitude in more seriously challenging all that.
Sure.
And whether or not there's an analogy to, you know, Sanders is now making a something of a stink of what's gone down in Nevada just recently, but has he more seriously challenged the rigging, you know, the way these primary processes are rigged? Let's get into that, perhaps, if you're interested, in a bit. But Jim is back on the line and patiently waiting once again. So let's go right to Jim. Hello, you're on the air.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Good. I'd like to introduce a measure of historical perspective to create some balance in this discussion regarding so-called spoilers, as you referred to Nader. The election of 2000 was stolen. It is well documented that the election was stolen in Florida with the assistance of Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris, etc. And also, Gore threw in the towel immediately. And I find it rather disgusting, and that's an appropriate word, at this point in history, to disregard this fact. And I'd like to hear what your host, whoever he is, I'd like to hear what he has to say about this, please.
I thought I just talked about the Supreme Court. Maybe he didn't hear my comments if he was... But I just talked about the Supreme Court stealing the election and everything, so...
We'll elaborate, you know, on that, though.
They did, but the reality of the spoiler argument is real. I think, as I said before, it was unfairly applied to Nader regarding the situation in Florida in 2000. But the argument is a real argument. If Sanders were to run as an independent this year, he would have to if somebody thinks that there's, you know, and I think that a very good argument could be made for this, that Clinton and Trump are equally distasteful, great. Then you want Sanders to run as an independent, then you want to vote for third party and so on. And I think that there's a very good argument to be made for that. I think a lot of people think that Clinton is a very negative candidate, but that they are genuinely fearful and hateful of Trump. And I think that there are a lot of people who are the exact mirror image of that, that they will end up voting for Trump because they view Clinton as a monster. You know, when I use the term spoiler, I'm talking about the effect, the perception, and the perception is real, and the possibility of, you know, if Mitt Romney runs for the presidency, it will likely have the effect of helping Clinton gain the White House. If Sanders runs for the presidency, it will increase the chances, in all likelihood, that Trump will win the presidency.
As an independent, yeah.
Yeah. So, I, you know, That's not to say that he shouldn't. That's to be clear-eyed about the minds that lay before us if we're serious about wanting to make change here. My gripe with Nader and everybody else is that they have not been clear-eyed and serious and leveling about how they actually achieve winning the White House. I think if Jill Stein this year, and by the way, Sanders has not responded to Jill Stein, the presumptive Green Party nominee, sent a letter to Sanders, I think, a month ago. He hasn't responded. And she just had a piece, I think, saying, you know, I'm not waiting around. So, you know, the likelihood of Sanders running as an independent or with the Green Party is very small. And the likelihood of him ultimately not getting the nomination, I think, is fairly high. I think he's acknowledging that at this point. So what do we do with that? If Jill Stein can position herself to get, you know, if Jill Stein starts going up in the polls, right, the entire mechanism of the Democratic Party and a lot of so-called progressives are going to come down on her as a so-called spoiler, that, you know, if she starts getting, you know, 7%, 10%, 15% in the polls, which, again, are also rigged. We can go into that if you want. Then what happens? Then you're going to hear MSNBC and probably Democracy Now, which has barely mentioned Jill Stein and the Democrat. I mean, I think I've made more mentions on this show of Jill Stein and the Green Party than Democracy Now! Has this entire year. You know, this entire so-called progressive apparatus will come down on her, and you got to plan for that.
So I think we have another caller on the line. If Mike is still with us, let's bring Mike up.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Go ahead. You're on the air.
So, yeah, I think the guest's analysis is spot on. I think that if I agree that if that Bernie has a low chance of somehow pulling off the nomination, and if he doesn't, then I don't know what our hopes are. I'm positive that he's not going to run as an independent, and I don't know to what extent we can direct the movement to the Green Party candidate. But the reason I was calling was earlier you were talking about, or you made a brief mention of a left-right alliance, and my thought on that is there's clearly a number, and I think Sanders has tried to run on the idea that there's a lot of meeting ground between those on the left, like libertarian and the libertarian and the Green Party have a lot in common as far as breaking up big banks, perhaps. There's a lot to say on that, but how do we get past all of the barriers, which are the social issues like abortion and marijuana, etc., and come to some agreement or compromise and overthrow the corporate power?
Excellent. Thank you very much for that. This is a core issue that I'm trying to get at with VotePact.org. And what I'm saying is very similar to what you're saying, and that is that there are all of these issues that there is agreement between principled progressives and conscientious conservatives. War, constant intervention, the corporate state, corporate trade deals, civil liberties, Wall Street bailouts, education, turning, education into a clerical job instead of meaningful, engaging instruction, and the corporatization of education with nonstop testing and so on and so forth. There's a whole litany of issues that there is intersection between principled progressives and conscientious conservatives. And you see this, and you've seen this for some time, going back to the first Iraq war, if not before then, when the establishment then was railing against the McGovern-Buchanan axis. And since then, you've seen Kucinich and Ron Paul intersecting on a lot of these issues. But you're right; this should be entered into with clear eyes as well. That there are serious differences: abortion rights, and many other, primarily social issues. And I think that there is a way, if you really start having a meaningful dialogue with people trapped on the other side of the two-party system, to try to overcome that. I think that if it's really meaningfully engaged, then it starts to question what people mean by something like pro-life, right? I mean, can people who say that they're pro-life because they're against abortion rights really mean that when, death penalty and wars and so on and so forth? I don't think that these issues can be resolved quickly or in the short term, but I think that those issues can be, not be made totally central to our politics, but be dealt with in a very serious way and in a more meaningful way, because right now they're not dealt with in a meaningful way. They're dealt with in a way to keep people in their partisan boxes, and that's the sum total of their effect. The Republican Party has made virtual slaves of evangelical Christians and others who might be open to dialogue with leftists on economic and foreign policy and other things, but they are totally trapped because of the question of abortion. So I think that there needs to be an honest dialogue about that to try to overcome that, to try to, if you had a left-right campaign to try to sort of have a truce on that subject, as, we would in effect transform the society. If we were a less warlike society and a less money-driven and corporatized society, then questions like abortion might appear different on the other end of that.
So thank you for calling.
On the other side of that mountain.
Thank you for calling, Mike. And we've got Shelley on the line. And then after we talk to Shelley, we've got a special guest, actually a couple, to talk about the victory on the banning of commercial water bottling operations in Hood River County. And we'll be going to that after Shelley. Shelley, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering what you guys might have to say about the idea. Well, first of all, I think that Trump is, and I think a majority of the voters in this country think that Trump is dangerous and we don't want him in the White House. And so if that's the case, then it seems like the most logical and patriotic thing would be for Hillary to drop out of the race, because Bernie, in poll after poll after poll for months, wins in a much larger margin against Trump than she does. And so I just wonder what you thought about that.
Well, I mean, I personally would agree with it. And the typical rebuttal from the Clinton camp is, well, Sanders hasn't been subjected to the same level of scrutiny that Clinton has, which I think is utter bunk. I mean, you've had, like the New York, the Washington Post and other major outlets, running, a dozen stories in a 48-hour period attacking his economic plans and so on. And I think that the tendency has been that the more people pay attention to the election, the more likely they are to vote for Sanders. So, I mean, I personally certainly agree with it. I just don't see a mechanism for compelling Hillary Clinton to drop out. She's got a lock on the Democratic Party establishment, and in all likelihood, barring, you know, her getting indicted or something, you know, she's going to be the nominee. You know, there are things that we want to happen but don't have the power to make happen. Unfortunate reality, but there are things that we can make happen. And I'm saying that come the conventions, if Clinton ends up being the nominee and Trump is the nominee, you have the two most negative people on the American stage, American political stage, as the nominees. What do you do with that? You try to coalesce people who dislike both of them and perhaps pair people together in order to get people, in order to save people from voting for someone that they hate, that they dislike because they don't want somebody who they hate. And the only thing keeping this system together, the only thing keeping Clinton and Trump as center stage, is the hatred that a large part of the American public has for the other one. And we have to break out of that. And the only way to break out of that hate is some measure of love. That principled progressives have to show some measure of love for conscientious conservatives to overcome this two-party divide, or else we're going to be perpetual slaves to this two-party system.
Shelley, are you still with us? I guess Shelley's gone. So at this point, Sam, you can stay with us if you want. For as long as you want, but we have another little segment I'd like to go to now. So feel free to stay on the line. Or
I should bow out, but okay. I'd be delighted to come back.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And especially in a pinch like this at the last minute, we really, really appreciate it.
I'm your backup. All right. Then.
And again, Sam Husseini, you're with the Institute for Public Accuracy. You want to give us a couple sentences on what you all do?
Well, IPA, which is accuracy.org, gets critical information out, especially to media outlets, on a daily basis. Critical news releases, you know, on a wide variety of subjects, from foreign policy to economic policy. I'm working right now on a news release on Malcolm X's birthday is coming up in 2 days, so people look for that. But what I've been talking about here is my ideas around Vote Pact to get a principled left-right convergence going. So I hope people will check out votepact.org.
Okay. And thank you once again, Sam Husseini from Washington, D.C. Appreciate that.
Bye-bye.
Okay. And now on the line, we've got Aurora Del Valle with the Local Water Alliance. And I believe she also has Julia DeGraw with the Food and Water Watch. Hey, Aurora.
Hey, good morning.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hey. Hi, Julia. Congratulations.
Great night.
Were you all partying late last night?
Oh, yeah. It was great. It was, I mean, a landslide victory. We are so thrilled about what happened last night. And, wow, we're just pretty overwhelmed with how the voters have spoken.
So what was the vote count? I didn't even see yet.
What was it, 69? 69 or 70%?
Very close to 70%.
Wow.
Hood River County voters.
Awesome.
Said yes to protecting their water and no to Nestle.
Yeah, and I would expect it. And what was really exciting is, I think with the Cascade Locks vote, we got, I think, a little over 40% of the total vote, which, considering all of the crazy, you know, the Nestle's attempt and the local officials who really worked on the local officials, that just really proves that Cascade Locks residents, a sizable amount, really wanted to protect the water. So I'm very happy about that.
Hey, what was the turnout like? Do you know?
For
the total turnout?
Yeah, for voting in Hood River County.
Oh gosh, you think we'd have that information?
No, that's all right. I was just curious. I was wondering if this issue perhaps potentially brought more people out. I was just curious.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah? We had so many people who were so excited, you know, really passionate about this issue. And what's so exciting is that, you know, we expect that this is going to have just a ripple effect, obviously with the state of Oregon, but I think in other communities that our local community is inspiring many communities around the country to fight for their water and follow our lead to protect their water, because there are so many other industrial water bottlers like Nestle going after communities' waters throughout this country.
Mm-hmm. And we exceeded the average primary participation levels the day before Election Day. So, I mean, we definitely, the voters in Hood River County definitely exceeded the average turnout for a primary election by a long shot. We don't have the exact percentage right now, but it was definitely a larger than average turnout for a primary election.
So you know, it's kind of, I kind of have to ask the question, what do you anticipate happening next? Do you feel like Nestle is going to try to challenge this in the courts or what?
Yeah. Well, we expected that. We expect Nestle will try to legally overturn the will of the voters. So we're going to continue to need support from the public in this good fight. But in the meantime, right now, we've made history, and Nestle cannot, because it's law, they can't come into Cascade Locks and build their water bottling plant.
For the foreseeable future, for sure, because
yeah.
any legal challenge would take quite a bit of time, and they've already got the fight of their corporate lives on their hands.
Well, and I would say there's a very strong chance that's more than just killed in Hood River County for the foreseeable future, but that it really, really is over, at least this specific water bottling facility, because another next step is the voters have spoken loud and clear in Hood River County, and Governor Brown can advise the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to permanently retract its application for a water exchange for this water bottling facility. And that is definitely something that we'll be pushing for, is to make sure that the governor makes the decision and the Water Resources Department makes the decision that state-held water resources should never be allowed to be used by corporate water bottlers. So that's another the next step that Food and Water Watch and coalition groups who've been fighting Nestle for 7 years will continue to fight for.
And of course, I'll just say that Governor Brown is in an election herself, and I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I think I might have said something similar to that during the victory speech.
All right. Well, listen, we got another guest coming on. So once again, you know, you've all just put your hearts and souls into this. I know, Julie, you've been working on this for years and years and years and years. And I know, Rory, you and all the other people in the local Water Alliance have made a lot of sacrifices, put your own heart and souls and sweat and blood into this. And it just must feel real good to have it pay off so resoundingly.
Yeah, you know what's so exciting is that we're so proud that this measure had overwhelming bipartisan support. So it's a huge victory in our community.
Speaking of the left-right alliance that our last guest was talking about, Julia, go ahead. What were you saying?
I was just going to say there were folks' yards had Greg Walden and Local Water Alliance signs in them, as well as Bernie and Local Water Alliance signs. I mean, we've really, water matters to everyone, and this ballot measure really proves that point.
All right. Well, as my engineer Liam is getting our next guest, Josh Fox, on the line, any last thoughts? You know, what people can do in the meantime to support this issue?
We are going to be legally challenged, so please continue to support the Local Water Alliance.
Yeah.
We're gonna, you know, this is a huge victory, but it definitely isn't over. So,
yeah.
Well, keep your eyes peeled and keep your support coming.
Yes.
All right. That's localwateralliance.org, I believe. That's your website, right?
Yes, localwateralliance.org. You can see just some updated events on our Facebook page. So, Local Water Alliance on Facebook.
Okay. Thank you so much, Aurora and Julia.
Thank you, Paul.
All right. Yeah. All right. It's nice to have some success. So we are here at Wednesday Talk Radio. My name's Paul Rowland, and we've had a couple guests on talking about the elections, various aspects from the national to the regional, local to those people out in Hood River County. And we're going to have another guest who's in town for a few days, Josh Fox, who is an environmental documentary maker, activist, and banjo player extraordinaire, who gave the Portland premiere, was at present at the Portland premiere of his film, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. And he's going to be on, hopefully for the hour tomorrow on Thursday Talk Radio with me, the substitute host, for Joanne Hardesty, who's coming up in about 10 minutes to talk about local elections in a special live edition, call-in edition of Political Perspectives right after this program. Good morning, Josh.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. I'm still kind of on a high from that film showing last night. I mean, I know you've gotten, you know, a lot of love for this film, and nothing I can say will change anything. But boy, it was really an amazing journey into your own journey, and also journey around the world of just some amazing people and places. Talk a little bit about how you came to this film.
What's that?
Oh, just talk a little bit about making the film and now on the road.
This is really the third part, an unofficial third part in a trilogy of films that starts with the film Gasland and Gasland Part 2. Gasland is a film about fracking, which I made in 2010, which details sort of what happened when the oil and gas industry came to my backyard and decided that they were going to lease all the land all around me. And that was in Pennsylvania. And that took me all across the country to document the ills of fracking, water contamination, air pollution, health crisis. But when you work on anything related to fossil fuels, or really when you're just living on the planet Earth, the issues of climate change start to become extraordinarily important, you know. All of us have to be in some way concerned, deeply concerned about what's happening with the climate, because it will be a source of upheaval for everyone in our lives as we, you know, as we go forward. So the climate change question is one that weighs really heavily on anyone who's working on oil and gas. So this film starts with me just sort of inquiring about what is climate change? How does it work? What can we do about it? And then I quickly find out that we're so late in dealing with this crisis on an international basis, and that the film kind of hits a brick wall at about 100 miles an hour in the first 20 minutes, and I almost kind of quit and give up. But then I ask the question: what are all the things climate can't change? You know, what is so deep within us as human beings that no storm can take those things away? And that leads me on a journey all across the world to the Amazon, to indigenous environmental monitors who are investigating oil spills deep in the jungle, to human rights defenders in China working on the horrific air pollution situation there, to a group called the Pacific Climate Warriors, a band of 24 people from a dozen South Pacific Island nations who are blockading the coal ships in the port of Newcastle in Australia. Just unbelievable stories that kind of come out of nowhere and pull me all across the earth. And it's really an amazingly dark, a journey to the center of the climate crisis. But then, of course, pulling out of that time and time again, in some of the most inspiring stories with some of the most inspiring and heroic figures I've ever met in my life. So that's the sort of it in a nutshell. And we had an amazing opening last night. We have another screening tonight where I will be there in person doing a Q&A with Tim DeChristopher, an incredible climate activist and leader who will be with me tonight.
Yeah, and it's a great theater there too, the Cinema 21. It's a really nice
beautiful
atmosphere. So I just want to say, we only have a few minutes, and we're going to have the you will be on tomorrow, right?
Yes.
Okay, so we'll have time to be get more depth in depth into this. You know, Blake, I came back to the U.S. after like 14 years abroad in Italy, and I jumped right into the just for a few months into the mountaintop removal scene, and I witnessed, you know, I sat there like doing recon, you know, for like a whole afternoon, and saw and just watched them blowing up a mountain, and I was in the middle of that, you know, the climate ground zero camp, and with these amazing young people, probably many of whom you've met now over the years, and who are kind of forming the backbone of this resurgent climate movement now, them and many others who are coming along. And then, you know, I met a guy through whatever those circles and went to southwestern Pennsylvania and saw, I saw the, you know, what they were doing. They were preparing for the next invasion force of fracking. And you've experienced this more than I ever will. But my friends who were there in the middle of longwall mining country and holding out for a while and not selling their house, which had massive coal underneath. But as they were dealing with that and everybody else was selling out and their subsidence was happening everywhere, at the same time, you saw these massive trucks moving in to these, they got these big parking areas and they hadn't started fracking yet, but you saw the preparations. I'll never forget that. But,
Yeah, so much of America right now and so much of the world is totally under siege by the fossil fuel industry. We don't think about this a whole lot because right now we're in a moment where we're being told over and over again by climate scientists that we must switch from fossil fuel-based energy, coal, oil, and gas, to renewable energy, the wind and the sun. And in fact, it's true that the wind and the sun and renewable energy can supply 100% of our energy needs on this planet. And yet, at the same time, what's happening right now is the fossil fuel industry, motivated by greed and profit, is expanding into everyone's backyard. Everyone across this nation, and we're on tour right now, we're doing something called the Let Go and Love Tour at for how to let go of the world and love all the things climate can't change. We're doing this tour in support of all these cities that are incredibly vulnerable to climate change, and we're fighting off the fossil fuel industry. Here in Oregon, you've had fights against pipelines and against LNG terminals, liquefied natural gas terminals. And this really becomes a political struggle, a struggle about greed, a struggle about our values. You know, because what the fossil fuel industry would rather do is, it seems like, live on a toxic planet where they inject chemicals into the ground, where we have carbon dioxide and methane and other greenhouse gases and other pollutants pouring into the atmosphere, heating up the earth. And the consequences are extremely dire, not just for what in our own backyards, you know, with that fossil fuel infrastructure, which is incredibly toxic and bad for public health and ugly, and but also for the climate. And when we're talking about climate change, we have already warmed the earth by 1 degree Celsius. We have enough carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere right now to have a radiative effect for several decades to bring the earth to 1.5 degrees Celsius change. Now, that doesn't sound like so much, but if you heated up your freezer by 1 degree, everything inside of there that's supposed to stay frozen would start to melt, and that's exactly what's happening on the planet Earth. We're melting the polar ice caps, we're rising sea levels, and we're in store for 5 to 9 meters of sea level rise if we stay on this trajectory, and really soon. That means all of our major coastal cities are in deep, deep trouble. Along the East Coast, along the West Coast, these are things that we absolutely have to address as a community and as a society, and that's why we're holding these screenings with Q&A sessions. We're doing music before the screening. We're doing music after the screening at a local bar. We're having these amazing discussions with people about how to get involved. And if you go to the screening, you can actually sign up to get yourself renewable energy through a renewable energy expert service that is free of charge. So there's all these ways in which we're trying to get people out into the theater talking about these things. It's actually been an amazing time. We have a dance party that erupts every night at the theater. You know, this is actually quite, I don't know, this is the only way that I know to address this crisis. And so far it's been going extremely well across the nation. We have...
All right, we got to run, Josh.
We have an amazing time.
So yeah, thanks for that little foretaste of for tomorrow. And thank you so much for joining us, Josh Fox. All right.
Oh, thanks so much. And people can get information at howtoletgomovie.com.
Howtoletgomovie.com. And again, tonight at Cinema 21, there will be another screening of that at and tomorrow night as well. But only tonight will you be able to see in Portland Josh Fox and Tim DeChristopher. But if you're in Kalama or nearby, there'll be another screen with Josh and Tim tomorrow evening, Thursday at 6 p.m. That's all we got time for. We got to run. This is Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Roland. Stay tuned for Joanne Hardesty with more talk radio on political perspectives coming right up. Thanks, Liam, for engineering, and stay tuned.
White Man Said Walk. The Teresa Rayford Disorderly Conduct Trial Show airs Wednesday, May 18th, 7 to 8 p.m. Here's Prosecutor Lowe trying to question Ms. Rayford.
It's probably more than fair to say that you are very upset by the fact that you were arrested, is that correct?
I'm not upset by the fact that I'm arrested. I'm a protester, so a lot of the reason that we protest is to communicate the inequities about what's happening. And the fact that I was arrested gives us that opportunity. Thank you.
That's White Man Said Walk, this Wednesday, 7 to 8 p.m. on KBOO, your community radio station.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock, and you are tuned to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, on Political Perspectives, Joanne Hardesty hosts a look at the Oregon primary with a focus on the local races. She will invite your calls. Stay tuned for that. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll hear Flashpoints featuring an encore broadcast with investigative economist James Henry, looking at how various dictators, drug traffickers, and corporate leaders stole $12 trillion from the world's poorest countries and held it offshore. At 11 o'clock on The Food Show, host Chris Siegel speaks with Anna Thomas, author of the Vegetarian Epicure Cookbooks, about her new book, Vegan, Vegetarian, Omnivore. Chris also interviews Lynn Curry, Eastern Oregon resident and author of the book Pure Beef. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support during our spring membership